Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua. With guest co-hosts...
Canuck Soldier.
MMC.
Dan was working his magic on it.
Yep.
Yeah, he makes all of this sound...
coherent, for sort.
Good in the end. Welcome to episode 69 of Polycast. Joining me for this sexual recording is Dan Q.
If I could play 500 turns, then I would play 500 more just to be the man who played 1,000 turns, got up to pee, but fell down at the door.
He apparently has way too much time on his hands now.
Apparently.
Also joining us today is Makalua.
Hello.
Cartamandua.
I am not joining you for this sexual podcast.
Oh, everyone's doing it. John Ryder, Canuck Soldier on the forums.
Hi, everyone. Don't worry, you don't have to worry about me singing.
And Stuart Rice, MMC on the forums.
Hello.
That's right. Four guys, two girls. Let your minds wander.
Imran, seriously.
In the Senate, we talked about attacking directly from a transport, how do we deal with barbarians, and putting your city one off of the coast. Is that bad?
In the research lab, we talked about the concepts of developing a professional army and a black market for mercenaries, and whether we should have a mechanism for building aqueduct roads in order to terraform desert.
In forum talk, we discussed about vassalage and theocracy, so happy together. Some reasons why I, just me, have decided to stop playing this game. And our favorite Beyond the Sword feature post-release and patches and how they differ from what we originally thought we'd like.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Well, as far as amphibious attacks, it's a fairly straightforward topic. Yes, you take a 50% penalty if you don't have an amphibious promotion.
I just tend not to do it, because I tend not to get that far in the game. Or at least when I do, it's naval warfare is kind of not really necessary for me, I find.
Yeah, it's just the only time it's really necessary is when you're trying to get the last city of an enemy and it happens to be on a one-tile island. I have seen that happen too many times. Then the solution is transport full of Marines or transport full of Navy SEALs if you happen to be the Americans.
In the world of slightly more intelligent AI, normally called human players, we do use this a fair bit simply for the tactical advantage of not having to land beside the city and having to attack next turn. Of course, going along with that, the double move, moving the ship in at the end of the last turn and then the beginning of the next turn, and then directly attacking off the boats. So this does have a definite place in some game types, although ancient world, no one even probably builds boats other than fishing boats.
I've found that it's often, even when playing with humans, it's actually often sometimes better if they're on a large enough island, then you just land outside of their borders where they can't see you and just charge in from there. They start to wonder where on earth you came from. You also don't have to worry about any amphibious promotions or anything like that.
Yeah, that's true, but if they happen to have a good sentry net, you're probably not going to catch them by surprise, but that depends on the proficiency level of the player, too.
If you are going to decide, no, I'm not going to assault directly from a transport, I'm going to land, John had mentioned that having to wait a turn and you could possibly be wiped out, it's important to note what units you have that you're going to send on an invasion and know what is in that city. Now, you may have to, for instance, keep open borders for a while to be able to move a unit in there, you know, a naval unit in there to see what's in that city. Or if you're lucky and you have caravels and you don't need to worry about that, but know what's there, know what you can bring to be able to adequately defend, because, again, as John said, you'll have that turn if you decide not to attack amphibiously, But also look at the terrain around the city. If you can land your units, say, on a hill, or even better, if a forest, or even better still, a hill with a forest, because the AI doesn't chop next to their city. Idiots. Then that could be advantageous, but that is also situational. But just something else to take in mind. I think always, 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 even with the penalty of attacking amphibiously, without the amphibious promotion, check the combat odds. What units are left in the city? What units do I have still left? If you bring enough units, sure, you might lose a few, but you'll be able to soften them. Of course, you can't use siege units, so you'll have to soften from some other means, from a transport. But you can soften them, and you could still take that city that turn, or make it so that next turn it's not going to be so bad to land and then take the city.
Well, if you had two transports, one with all your siege units and non-amphibious units that landed next to the city, and a second one which then just pounded the city directly, which had a few amphibious units, then that would help soften them up ready for the second stack to attack the next turn. So you'd basically keep a constant turn-by-turn attack charging in.
Or you just bring some frigates along with you and soften the city up with them prior to moving your transports in.
Or you do all three. Barbarians, how do you deal with them? It's definitely a case of there are multiple ways of... Do you fight them? Do you just let them ignore you? Do you build the Great Wall and send them to other people? Personally, I tried to build the Great Wall, if no one else has. Certainly makes the early game easier. It also helps you get a great spy later on as well, which can be awesome if you really need to get a couple thousand espionage points against an opponent, instantly see all their cities.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'll consider the Great Wall from time to time, but generally just speaking, I'm noting what turn it is in the game to consider, okay, when are we going to move away from these barbarian animals to see more barbarian units, and ensuring that I have decent defenders in my cities. I've got my archers, but more importantly than that, I've got, say, axemen, so they come around with swordsmen or axemen themselves or even spearmen. I've got some defense there, and I've got some offensive power to take them out. Because barbarians, for me, I'm not concerned about their taking my cities most of the time. And I'm more worried about them pillaging my lovely terrain improvements. So what's important, particularly early on, if you don't have roads in the vicinity of certain things, because I find that depending upon what the improvement is, I won't build a road right away. And what I'll do is I will take some of those units out of my city and have them along the border as kind of a border patrol. All the better if you can move those units of yours, say, onto a hill to give you better visibility, just like you do with a scout, for instance. And also trying to choose terrain just within my border or just outside my border that gives me some additional defense, like a jungle or a forest or even on a hill, to be able to better defend, because it gives you kind of an early warning system. If you're not able to take them out with the units that are on your early warning system, then the units are going to take the time to destroy that unit, probably going to weaken themselves, and then they've still got to move into your territory, giving you time to either build more units where you need them and or move more units where you need them to be.
I'd have to say, like one of the posters, I deal with barbarians by turning them off in the settings. Playing primarily MP, I have enough issues not dying to my neighbors, let alone this barbarian sneaking up on me from behind.
Actually, I think the most annoying thing about barbarians can be when you have a coastal city and the barbarian galleys come around and you don't have one and they start pillaging your seafood resources. Usually I find that those are the ones that are able to last because it's before triremes typically. And I'm thinking, you know, one galley to go after this galley is probably not going to be enough. I'm probably going to have to build two to be able to defeat it entirely. And I'm always checking the combat odds and always thinking, do I let it attack me? Or do I attack them? And once I've built it, and I'm looking at the combat odds, if it looks like I'm going to lose in the combat, certainly if it's anything less than 50%, then I just let it attack me and hope it has the same end result that I figured I would have gotten. And of course, we all love, if you got random events, the raging barbarians. Although, you know, sometimes that is cause for concern, and other times I find my heart leaps out of my chest for absolutely no reason. Sometimes it's bad. It's like, ooh, six swordsmen, and I'm still trying to get my copper and or iron hooked up.
I did once have that event when I had Raging Barbarians. They all appeared on this tiny little piece of fog, which was trapped completely by my culture, and I had the Great Wall. So basically, there's something like six or eight barbarians trapped on six or eight tiles.
Ah, well, that's just target practice then.
I was about to say.
Yeah, that's free experience points there.
As far as barbarians go, we've dressed the units, but also the animals. Well, they're definitely not as big of a problem because they can't get into your cultural borders, but you do want to defend your settlers and any workers you're sending out. Bad enough to have it eaten by a barbarian unit or another civ deciding to take advantage of your undefended settler, but to have it eaten by an animal, oh. So I think, yeah, with barbarians, yeah, you could turn them off. I wouldn't recommend anybody check the raging barbarians. Sometimes it's kind of like a checking aggressive AI. You're thinking, I'm not quite good enough, go to the next level, but this level kind of standard settings is too easy. I want something kind of in between, so you can play with that and the aggressive AI to add some more flavor.
One tile away from the coast, is it as bad as having a city in the middle of the continent rather than, if you're that close to the coast, is it worth just moving one tile over and making it a coastal city or not? Because you can have the bonus of being near water in your BFC, and yet can't use, as second poster in the thread says, can't build a lighthouse, can't build a harbour, can't build ships, but you could presumably get hold of food resources from the water.
Well, I really think in, I'd say, 90% of situations, move to the coast. There's simply very few tactical situations that are going to make up in the long run for not having coastal resources, the lighthouse, the trade routes, etc., etc. It would be very niche strategy that you would benefit from moving one tile inland just for, I don't know, defensive purposes.
Yeah, then you can prevent the transport attack.
Well, it could be a case of if you've got couple of food resources on the coast, and you've got, say, iron or something, just one tile in, so you have to go one tile in to get it in your fat cross, to get everything in your fat cross at once. There could possibly be that situation, but...
It could be, but I would probably build a second city just close and do it that way.
And another consideration also is that, yes, there might be some seafood resources on the coast, and you're settling inland because, towards the example Stuart was giving, so you could also have iron in your big fat cross, and that way you'll know you'll have it once your culture borders expand sufficiently. You could have another coastal city nearby, say, build a workboat, and then move that in to have that tile work. But yeah, it's a starting location issue. I think we've talked about this before, whether or not, oh, let's use this turn to move my settler to another tile, and moving to one tile over, like I'm moving into a forest or something, so that means I'm actually going to have to wait next turn to be able to do that. And I would say if you have to do that to get to the coast, don't do it. But if you're able to do it so that, like, if you're on a grasslands tile and you're moving over to another grasslands tile and that other grasslands tile happens to be the coast, that falls, I think, under the 90% of the time that you do want to be on the coast. I guess the only other consideration might be your map type. If you're playing islands, for instance, then depending upon how large the island is, you might be taking a gamble at, oh, well, I'll take the risk of not settling on the coast here in the hopes that once I explore the rest of the island, I'll find a decent city that can get access to the coast and still have sufficient hammers to be able to produce my naval units.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but may be in the future.
We have a poster here who is looking at the concepts of a professional army and or a black market system within Civ. Basically a way of adding to the diplomacy by being able to sell your units as a professional army, much like it's happened in real history. And, of course, the black market concept, which is just being able to sell your units for cash and not having anyone know who it is that is selling and who it is buying.
The professional army idea, maybe, but black market, kind of like what Kamikaze was getting at. I don't think we really need both.
Yeah, I think the black market is definitely too much open to abuse during the game. It's kind of like, you know, having pirates on steroids.
Well, I tell you, I can see them as they're basically two sides of the same coin. The only difference is whether or not other people outside the trade know the trade has taken place. Which, even in the case of a professional army, if they're not paying attention, then they're not necessarily going to know.
And if we're going to have a black market type thing, why couldn't we have it sell resources that we can't get our hands on?
Well, say the black market could be, instead of trading resources with another Civ, you trade with some non-Civ AI market, but it costs twice as much or something.
Yeah, or it's the AI selling their resources under a cover.
Maybe black market would be better served under the espionage umbrella somehow.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, it could link into that, yeah.
As an espionage mission, you basically order your spies to purchase something from the black market.
Or, better yet, your spies can get into a city, steal their stuff.
And sell it.
Yeah. And then you're selling somebody else's resources.
Well, actually, you know, you can stop tech brokering and or even stop trading altogether so that people can't trade technologies unless they've researched them themselves or even not at all. The black market could then be an option around that. So normally you can't trade a tech. You can't trade someone else's technology unless you sneakily do it on the black market.
Though, you know, with the black market, you can kind of do that now indirectly through a combination of being able to gift units and just your standard diplomacy. Now, it's true I'm thinking more about being able to interact from human to human. Say, hey, you see those units on our border? And you're like, yeah, well, if I move those units and I gift them to you, and then you give me money, or give me money, and then I will give you those units. Now, it's true that in that particular situation, it's not simultaneous.
And it requires a certain degree of trust.
It does. I would think in that situation you would want to say money first, because if you gifted those units and you didn't even get any money, then it's like, okay, you know what? I am going to now take those units and use them to attack you, and I'll just get money too, along with the units.
Yeah.
Then that's another way you could go about it, at least human to human.
Mm.
But I like the professional army. Well, you know what? Perhaps maybe a bit of our reaction here to the negativity towards the black market and more positive to the professional army, now that I'm thinking about it, is the way the poster Waki has presented it. Professional army, he's fleshed this out a little bit more. But with the black market, don't know what's going on, diplomacy has no effect here. Whoa.
I think what he means is you can't pester an AI or someone to say, look, where did you get that unit from? They won't tell you. Or you can't negotiate a price or something, I don't know.
Or that it doesn't affect relationships. I do this for you, and it doesn't give you a plus or a minus.
Or you could trade with your worst enemy, and the fact that they hate you isn't taken into account because they don't actually know who they're buying from.
I also like the idea of slightly higher maintenance costs for those units.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. Definitely, when you're buying a professional army, or you can call them mercenaries or whatever, money is all they're interested in. So yeah, I think the maintenance costs would have to be higher.
You could almost argue that if it's professional army, rather than just to make it unique, rather than just gifting units for money, you could actually say they keep their own flag, but the player who's just bought them gets to give them orders. Whereas the black market units, they like privateers, they get no flag.
The only problem I see with that is, of course, the human player will be able to note that, hey, the flag color is different. Whereas if you're dealing with the AI, just changing the flag color alone, that's not going to be able to perceive that.
Well, so that's how you can tell. The ones with the different flag are the ones with the higher maintenance cost. That's how a third party can tell, oh, that's professional army. That'll probably have to be handed back at some point. That's an army that's being rented or something for so many turns.
Yeah, because the post doesn't really get into, like, it talks about 2 acts, spend with at least 2 experience points for 10 gold before 3 turns end. And it sounds like, I mean, that professional army, that becomes yours in perpetuity. And you're talking about now renting the army. Now, that's an interesting...
If you're talking about a professional, as in mercenaries, then they take a job. Once that job is done, they'll go and hire themselves out to someone else, won't they? They won't stay with the person who's hired them for the first mission. They'll go off to someone else.
Or what they could do is after X number of turns they've been your professional army, they're like, okay, we were in your employ for whatever those many turns were. Whatever you did or didn't do, regardless, you could say, okay, you want to retain us? Now it's going to cost you even more gold than the first time.
Yeah, else we go back to our original Civ.
I like that. It makes sense.
That would actually make it different from simply just saying, here, have some units, give me gold.
And for those Civs that might be in a particular situation, you might be behind in technology, but for some reason, you know, or otherwise your economy is doing very well, you can decide, well, I'm not going to be able to get these level of units on my own, and I've got the economy to support it, so I'm actually better off to do that, even though they've demanded more money.
Mm.
All these things you can take into consideration. So, yeah, still, professional army, I do like that, but the black market thing, oh.
It would have to definitely be fleshed out a lot.
And put it under the espionage system somehow, as a mission.
Although this does tie in with something else I sort of partially came up with and saw elsewhere, is an idea of trade goods, where you have everything you trade on in the diplomacy screen is a unit that you have to specifically take to your opponent, but can be captured and sold on the black market before it gets there. It can be ransomed and captured. So you trade a tech, you've got a guy carrying the blueprints to go to the other civ to give them the blueprints. And if he gets captured on the way, he can be ransomed, sold on the black market, whatever.
Okay, now if that's a possibility, then what mechanisms would be put in place to help defend against that possibility? For instance, would you tie that further to espionage? Like if your espionage was considerably higher, at least relative to another civ that you're dealing with, or...
Or you just have to defend the unit.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically as if you're gifting a worker or a settler to another civ. He can't defend himself. You have to use other units to defend it.
Ah, while it's en route to the borders to the other civ.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. And then if he gets captured, he can then be sold on the black market via the espionage screen or whatever. Or ransomed back to the original civ or just used.
It could be a good idea, but then they might say, well, it's too complex, like when they dropped the caravans in Civ 2 from Civ 3 and Civ 4. Because they felt that it was too complex methodology of trading goods. But there's still room for improvement, I think.
It would be a way of actually making the black market make sense. It's sort of, you've stolen something, and therefore you can't trade it in regular diplomacy. You have to use the black market.
Black market idea would definitely something have to be balanced out very carefully before it work, or it'd be open to abuse.
The professional army needing some balancing too, but I think it's farther along. It appeals to me more.
Yeah, it's mostly there. It's just a case of tweaking.
Shackle, the poster here, seems to think that basically in the historical context, maps with large amounts of desert that you can't do anything with isn't really in the interest of the game. His example, a civilization like Egypt, which flourished on a single river system in the middle of the desert, can't be done in Civ. That we don't have a way of engineering our water out to farm desert in Civ. I'm not sure that trying to emulate real history and ignore game balance is the way to go. But you do get large expanses of desert, but in the later game, desert is where your oil is too. So I think from a game balance perspective, if you're not getting into the later eras, desert kind of sucks. But if you're moving into later eras, the resources in the desert do have their benefits.
On the one hand, I like the idea, but then on the other hand, if you make it so that even over time, have the ability to farm desert terrain like this person talks about, you know, maybe around metal casting or masonry. Well, first of all, masonry would be far too early for that.
Definitely, yeah.
But still, it then opens up kind of, well, you can settle almost anywhere. Some people make the comment that there's unusable terrain. Don't put the unusable terrain on the map. Well, as John already pointed out, there is a reason to consider the possibility of at least some desert tiles because you could end up with oil there. And I think that that is the desert advantage. And it could end up being that there's this huge swath of desert, and then all around it, or on some sides of it, the terrain is fine. To the same end, perhaps you think about that desert. I don't want to settle that right now, but later on, that could be my source of oil. So I want to be able to settle around it, or at least part of it, so that later on in the game, I'm going to have it protected, if for nothing else than cultural borders, and maybe have some, of course, military to back that, so that when you can see oil, it's like, oh, look, there's oil there, so that you could go in and settle and get that oil, if it wasn't already within your cultural borders, of course.
He's talking about making it a sort of road, so instead of building your aqueduct in the city, you build it piece by piece out as far as you need it to go. But reading this thread, it actually makes more sense if it was actually a kind of artificial river rather than a road, supplying fresh water as it goes and blocking transport, because who actually walks down an aqueduct regularly?
I think we'd really have to be careful about the cost of something like that. You're terraforming is what you're doing. Changing desert into floodplains. And the benefits of that are pretty substantial, so the cost of building a large-scale aqueduct project like that shouldn't be cheap.
We had the engineers in Civilization 2 that allowed you to terraform, and in the later game it was like, wow, I loved it, but then I started to realize the abuse that could come there. Whereas now we don't have it at all, so maybe there is a happy medium towards that, but as you said, it would need to be expensive.
And also, a lot of these, Las Vegas isn't that far away from an actual river source. I think that you have to maybe make it so that you can build an aqueduct so many tiles out, but after that, the middle of the desert might be empty. Because that's the way it is in real life. You don't have a city in the middle of Sahara. The Mojave Desert has nothing there. You get out of Las Vegas, you get too far away from a water source, and there's nothing in the Mojave.
Yeah, every once in a while you've got some isolated desert tile, or you can settle the city so you have like one or two desert tiles, but they're near a couple tiles over or whatever within the city that's near water source. So maybe later on in the game, that particular desert tile, towards what you're saying there, Annalie, could become useful later on, although I'd still think it needs to be even farther down than metal casting. Whereas, yeah, just a whole bunch of desert in the middle of, and surrounded by a desert, no.
Personally, I'd keep it the current method of you build your aqueduct and in the city and it automatically winds to wherever. But then whichever path it uses, it's then treated as a river, which means that it can't be pillaged in the same. So you don't have that issue of cutting it in half. But you get a river out of the city that's artificial. But the thing is, you wouldn't be able to say, oh, just make it the whole desert livable. You only get what you see. If you really spend a lot of money, you can build a city in the desert if you ship in all the water and dig down and get your wells and that. But expensive late-game stuff rather than early.
Oh, yes. Las Vegas didn't happen until the 20th century. It would have been a little shack in the middle of nowhere in the 1800s.
There's some merit to the idea, but until the later game, it's definitely longer-term planning. Recognizing that it's going to take some time to get there, you have to think about, is it worth settling a city there before you're able to do that? It could very well be. And it just ends up being, well, these one or two tiles don't end up being useful until later on anyway.
Yeah, until electricity or something.
Which tech is it that lets you build farms without irrigation?
Civil service.
That would actually be probably a better tech to say, you have your aqueduct, and then at that tech, that your aqueducts suddenly start producing fresh water as well, perhaps.
So yeah, maybe around then, maybe around civil service, with the, also the condition of there being a water source. Now, whether that's a river or it could even be a lake.
It'd be a freshwater lake, yeah.
One or the other, as long as it's within a couple of tiles, then the desert could be improved that way. Otherwise, you end up gambling whether or not it'll have oil.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Lemon Merchant says, here's something I've been wondering about. Is there any benefit to running the Vassalage and Theocracy Civics at the same time? Both give you more XP per unit build, and Vassalage gives you a number of free units, but is there any point? I've never noticed if the XP bonus is cumulative, or if the game just gives you the bonus for one of the civics. Help. Please, quote-unquote.
It definitely is cumulative, because I've had it before.
This is great if you want highly promoted units, but are you willing to give up the benefits of other civics in the long term to use these two civics together and leaders and academies and stuff to get this? Because in the long run, giving up some other civics has some fairly substantial effects as well.
It depends whether or not you've actually got the choice of other civics. If you haven't got those techs yet, then sometimes it's quite an easy choice.
Well, I mean, Vassalage, Legal Civic, available with Feudalism, High Maintenance, New Units, receiving +2 experience points, and more free units. And then Theocracy being Religion Civic with Theology, Medium Maintenance, +2 experience points, and Cities with State Religion and no non-state religion spread. For me, if you were looking for new experience points, choose one or the other, because it's kind of what John was saying, you're going to be giving up something with Vassalage and the Legal Civic. The upkeep cost is high. Typically, I prefer actually to be staying at Barbarism until I can get to Bureaucracy and Civil Service, and that's about the same time as Vassalage anyway. If I'm looking for units to receive some additional experience points, I'm hoping by then I've had at least some kind of isolated war where I've got a great general in one of my cities, and so those non-mounted units getting +2 experience points, because of course you can get those double promoted units right away with mounted units, as we've talked about before with the barracks and the stable combination. Although I think that is the better one to go if you're actually looking for two experience units. Even though the maintenance cost is higher, you do get more free units, and the number is variable, I think, on your map size, if I remember correctly. Whereas with Religion and Theocracy, +2 experience points in cities with state religion, maybe in a situation where you haven't had a chance to spread your state religion to all your cities, I don't want to move away from my organized religion where cities with state religion construct buildings plus 25% faster. I know a lot of people talk about being able to build missionaries without a monastery, and I realize the upkeep cost is high. But I think unless you're in an immediate war situation, and those cities that can help you are at or near the front relative to be going to both theocracy and vassalage at the same time, that's beneficial. But otherwise... Some reasons why I've decided to stop playing this game, quote-unquote.
Oh, it's my topic!
So this person who started this thread, Andy Rookie, has said, after having played the game for several weeks, I've taken the decision to quit playing it. There are several reasons for this, and I tried to summarize what he said here. First, I overall sensed a lack of fun while feeling that I still needed to learn a lot more in order to be able to play comfortably at Noble, and once I succeed at Noble, the learning will restart at the next level and so forth. But as GHP Stage said, most people won't ever go past Noble, as that's what they enjoy, but I think Frotus has it when he says, no one starts off by winning at Noble. Yeah, why would you start at Noble? I can see why you'd be frustrated then, my goodness sakes.
I can understand playing your first game at Noble when you first get the game, because that's the default. You just want to get straight in the game, don't care about what difficulty it's at. You just play, see what it's like. But after that, you then pick the level you're comfortable with.
Yes.
Yeah, and this isn't a real-time strategy game. This isn't chess. It's not Axis and Allies. You got to expect that if you're going to play Civ, that there's going to be some complexity to it. Or you're going to end up not getting past Sid's tutorial at the start and calling it quits and hope that it was worth your $40.
He says also that the early game is clearly very important and perhaps too crucial. At the same time, from an entertaining point of view, I find this stage very boring. Are we playing on a huge map with like two or three Civs? Is that because you don't get encounters? Like, what do you mean boring?
Yeah, I don't think he's doing it right if it's boring on Noble.
He does say, if I choose to play on a huge continent with the intent to be left alone at the beginning, why the heck am I surrounded by so many other Civs?
Well, it sounds to me like he hasn't discovered custom game yet, that's all.
Yeah. He's probably picking huge and finding he's got 18 Civs, so it's quite a full world.
I won't argue the fact that Civ is an exponential game and decisions you make early affect greatly your progress throughout the game, but playing on Noble, even as a new player, you should be equal to the AI on Noble.
Yeah, because that is the fairest level, the human and the AI, supposedly. But I would think that, I don't even say you might want to go down to Settler, but actually just knock yourself down to Warlord, and then try that, and if that's still too difficult, then go down again. He also talks about early on doesn't guarantee me a steady rise above neighboring civilizations on the scoreboard. The score can be so misleading, especially early on. I mean, when I see a really high score early on in the game, I'm thinking, oh, that person is not whipping. That person is letting their cities grow. And so I'm thinking, your score is high, your military is probably crap. Don't just look at the scoreboard. You've got to be looking at the power graphs and the demographics.
Yeah, that just says there's a civ out there that wants to donate their cities to me. That's all that says.
I just don't know it yet. The sort of choices you are forced to make and which appear to have an impact on the outcome seem to demand a level of attention and strict micromanagement that I'm simply not prepared to meet, quote-unquote. Well, I think that even ties, again, to the lower difficulty levels. And, of course, strict micromanagement is a relative consideration. But on the higher difficulty levels, yeah, there are more things that you have to think about. You need to be thinking not just that turn, but a few turns down the road, maybe even 10, 20 turns down the road. And so while you're trying to master the ability to do that, don't hurt yourself so much by being so high on the difficulty level. Make it so that you're able to ease into it. I mean, if I had started at Noble and stayed at Noble playing Civ 4, I wouldn't be doing this podcast right now. I'd have been so frustrated. I would have went, damn you, Civ 4, damn you! That would have been the end.
Well, like some of the other posters, this guy, probably Civ isn't his game. If he finds the complexities of Civ too much to handle. In the multiplayer world, the ability to micromanage is what separates the average player from the above-average player. I have guys in multiplayer that complain there's not enough micromanagement to separate the real elite players from the just average players. So there's both sides of the coin here.
Shackle, he said in response, towards that, no, I'm not being the game for you. From the looks of it, Andy Rookie wants to easily master the game with not as many challenges and to have it simplified, and he says try CivRev. think that if you're finding Civ 4 frustrating and all these considerations, even as you move down the difficulty level, because whatever the difficulty level happens to be, there is going to be a level of micromanagement. So perhaps Civ Rev would be something that this person would enjoy more. And then if you get comfortable with that and decide, I want more of a challenge, then you could look at Civ 4 again. It is expectations. I think a lot of it here is expectations about what he thinks he's going to be able to do and how long it's going to take him to do it.
He does allude to some other games, like Eastern Front and The Art of Operational War.
Which are simplified, battle-oriented games, as opposed to, like, there's no economic model or, you know, diplomatic model in some of these games. But he doesn't really state what his idea of fun is either, whether fun is just being able to produce a lot of cheap units to go on an attack, or just being able to plug cities out and not be interfered with. So it's hard to say what he's missing in Civ 4, but, you know, Civ 4 is a complex conquer the world. It's a god game. You know, I don't think there's any way of getting away with this. Civ 2 is complex, Civ 3 is complex, and Civ 4 is complex. Just we altered the mechanics.
Yes.
There's lots of casual Civers out there that they come on, they play for a couple hours, things don't work out, I had fun, and they move on. You don't have to master this game to have fun at it.
I wouldn't be surprised if he hasn't tried any of the mods or anything, because some of the mods are actually a lot simpler, because they're not the full complex Civ, they're just simplified, here's a scenario, play through.
They're a subset of the game, or playing something like, there's a large Earth map community out here that plays nothing but these Earth maps, which are not balanced in the least, but they're fun to play because you're playing the real world.
Actually, one thing I noticed, technically, by posting this thread, he's doing this. It's probably half these questions. He says, oh, I've got this. Why have I got these problems? Why have I got these problems? The easiest answer is, there are community websites out here. You found one. Use them. Ask the questions. There are going to be plenty of people who are willing to answer and tutor you and help you find the fun in the game.
He does cite that, and he thinks that he says, this is ridiculous that I have to go back to the forums time and time again for advice, and then he disses the manual. Now, I can understand that in certain respects. The manual for the game is not for strategy.
It's telling you what you can do, not how to do it.
Yeah, it tells you what buttons to press and where the menus are, and after that, well, you know, move on.
The manual gives you data on the game. It does not give you information about the game. It's not making sense of that data. Combination of doing that yourself through trial and error, and also the forums. I think my favorite quote in this thread is from Jonathan Strange. I think if I'd used all the time I'd spent playing Civ, I'd earned another degree, learned another language, made dozens more friends, traveled the country more. That's it. I'm giving up Civ 2 right after I teach those effing Babylonians a lesson once and for all. We last discussed this in April of 2007 in episode 13, when then we were asking what our favorite Beyond the Sword feature was probably going to be before we got the game. Well, we've had the game for a little while now, and we've had a few patches here and then. So I did find it interesting, looking at this thread, started by Cybershy, now Robert Plump. He had started this thread, and you had to choose just one. And looking at the poll, corporations is actually in the lead. Wow, I think that we need a sober second thought now on that being in the lead.
Oh, we all learned our lesson there.
The options being expanded epic game, new civs, new leaders, new scenarios, espionage events, new wonders, apostolic palace, advanced starts, enhanced AI, expanded space race, and corporations. I would have to say now, what is my favorite Beyond the Sword feature? I'm going to say espionage. That certainly leaves me in the minority in the poll anyway, and maybe on the panel. I thought about random events, and I mean, it is a feature, but I don't know, it's because it's so random, and it's hard to quantify because you may or may not get a random event, and if you do, it's going to be different, it's going to appear at different times. Sometimes random events, the options that are available to you, depending upon when they appear in the game, some are not possible. I think of the artist performing a ballad, and if you haven't discovered the radio technology, then you can't give them an advertising contract. That was kind of hard to compare. So because of that, I'm going to go with espionage now, that it's my favorite feature that Beyond the Sword introduced to Civ 4.
For me, I'd say espionage is definitely one of the features that has definitely made the game interesting. I'm not sure if I was looking forward to it, but it's definitely made it. But actually, the feature I was most looking forward to was actually the expanded space race. Because I've always been a big fan of the Civ 2 style space race, where you build your ship and you don't know if you've won yet. Basically, if your capital gets taken before it gets there, you lose. The fact that it's not an instant win. And so it's the adding that feature back in is probably what I was looking forward to most in Beyond the Sword. It definitely hasn't disappointed there. But yeah, espionage is probably a good second, and events was another interesting.
Oh, so before Beyond the Sword, you didn't find Civ 4 interesting, eh?
No, I meant those were the interesting parts of Beyond the Sword. Those were the bits I was looking forward to. Civ 4 was interesting, but it needed those finishing touches.
I kind of wish I could see what I voted in, or if I voted in this thread, but I think I probably, knowing how I was then, probably would have said New Civilizations, because I like the idea of the diversity and the excitement of who they're going to put in and what are they going to do.
Well, if you log into your forum account, you can see what you voted for.
Really?
Yep, because I voted for the Apostolic Palace.
I apparently didn't vote in this thread.
Uh-oh.
Neither did I. Do you think it's worth us voting now? Just see if we can change the game?
I'm sure I would have said it was the Civilizations. Plus, I had Alexander in my ear constantly. Babylonians? Babylonians? I mean, it was like, please get a new civilization of the Babylonians in there so I don't have to hear this anymore.
I voted for events, but I think it was a close between that and New Civs. But I still kind of like the idea of events.
Well, I'm not sure I voted in that poll. I don't think I did. But I would say at the time, I was hoping that Advanced Starts would put a lot of options into the game. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out so great. It wasn't implemented as well as it could be, and it's not really been used by a lot of players.
Oh, good. I don't have to drop you from the call now, John. Okay, continue.
Oh, dear.
Oh, that was you the first time?
Oh, we weren't going to say anything.
Advanced Arts had a lot of potential, but I don't think we had enough time to really work on it in the playtest, and it never really got balanced right. So hopefully maybe that's something we can work on in the next iteration of Civ. I'll probably hop on the espionage bandwagon. Not so much the overarching espionage screen, but the use of spies in particular really added something to the game. Like being able to poison someone's water supply or, you know, incite revolt in a city. Those are nice, but I really think sending spies in and destroying roads and prior to attack adds a tactical advantage.
So far, that's two people for espionage, one person for events, one person for New Civilizations.
Well, now I really like the events.
Oh.
The Civs are cool, but I really enjoy the events because I think they add a new angle, and I've always been a defender of the events.
I don't think I voted in that, but I'd have to go with espionage, too, because there's so many fun things you can do. Especially when you're in a later game and you need to slow somebody down. Poison water is awesome. Oops, how did your city go from 20 to 15? I have no idea.
So if there are people out there still trying to decide what their favorite Beyond the Sword feature is post-release, jump on the espionage bandwagon. Not only do we have cookies, we have more cookies.
Calling today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to episode 69 with Daniel Quick.
You know you loved it.
Imran Siddiqui.
Yeah, I can't believe they let me on again either.
Carter Mandor.
I'm too young for this.
Makalua.
I don't think you can hear the facepalm I'm doing right now through the internet.
John Canuck Soldier.
Well, I'm sure that Dan thinks he's made a mistake for a second time.
And myself, Stuart MMC Rice. Thanks for listening.
Say it again.
Who invited him again?
You know, with guest co-host this on top of messing with Imran, Mackie and I don't have to do anything.
Oh my gosh, we're redundant.
Oh no.
You can join Imran.
Record date?
May 16th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009 Civilized Communication at civcom.net.